Amiga. You know, sometimes you have to get here early to get the best seats. This is getting worse than the grand final. There comes a day here where you have to be queuing up on a Thursday evening just to get a place here on a Friday. But anyhow, for the time being, even though it's sometimes we outgrow the space and it's sometimes not that easy to get a nice comfortable place, but it's still a place where you can sit down. Because I just remembered something I said at the beginning of the meditation about complaining about the dogs, because it's a waste of time complaining about the dogs, because they just, that's what they do, they bark. So I thought the nice topic for a talk tonight is no complaints. Because we spend half our life complaining. And I don't know how old you are now, but has anyone ever listened? A waste of time, isn't it? But why do we complain so much? There are a lot of times where we start complaining about life, about our husband, about our wife, about our kids, about our parents, about our government, about our monks, about our nuns, about our Buddhist society, about... There's so many things you can complain about. But sometimes, what's the effect of that? Does that really help, you know, the situation? And a lot of times I think that one of the great assets of a Buddhist path is like learning how to change the way we look at life so we complain less and we have more happiness. So instead of trying to change the world, we just change the way we look at it. I don't know about you, but it's so hard to change the world. But it's not that hard to change your attitude to life and the way you look at it. And one way of changing the attitude towards life is having less complaints and a bit more compassion and kindness towards life, yourself and the people you live with. But I don't know about you. Sometimes people complain about me. Oh, you tell silly jokes. Or, you know, use a shit word. Or you just... I told people that it's... I know, because as far as Buddhism is concerned, we're all conditioned beings. In other words, we are the product of all the influences which go into us. And so the only reason why I tell silly jokes was because my father told silly jokes. And I grew up with that conditioning for such and such a long time. So what do you expect? That's obviously the way that I'm going to be. And it's the same in the local language, because you hear it every day. And that's actually what you say. So, you know, don't blame me. It's all your fault. Or my father's fault. When we understand it's all conditioning. Oh, this is actually a nice story about conditioning. I'm not sure when I told this last joke. About the Brazilian goalkeeper. Don't remember this joke? Okay. This is a very good story about conditioning. Because you know how hard, like, soccer players have to train. Sometimes have to keep doing the same movement again and again, shooting the ball, the same direction, until it becomes like a conditioned part of them, just second nature. They do it automatically. Now when the ball comes across their head, it's automatic. But anyway, this was happened in Rio de Janeiro, in a very poor part of one of the great Brazilian cities. And in a very old building, there was a fire. And the fire brigade hadn't turned up yet. And at the top story there was a woman with her baby. And the flames were getting closer and closer to her apartment. And she was screaming for help, help, help. And a great crowd had gathered round. Where's the fire brigade? Where's the fire brigade? They're not going to get here in time. And they were really afraid that this woman and her baby would lose their life. And then through the crowd came this big burly man. And he said, drop the baby, I'll catch it. He said, no one can catch it, it's too high up. He said, of course I can catch it. Don't you recognize me? I'm the goalkeeper for the Brazilian national squad. I've never let in a penalty for the last 3 years. I can save anything. Drop the baby. He said, I can't. And they all said, drop it. Because they recognized him, he was the goalkeeper of the Brazilian national team. And then a big flame came so close she had no choice. She dropped the baby. And the goalkeeper crouched down. And the whole crowd went absolutely silent. as a baby tumbled through the air, getting closer and closer to the ground. At the last moment, the goalkeeper leapt to his right, and he caught the baby, and they rolled three times with the baby in his arms, and all the crowd cheered. And as he punched the air, the goalkeeper dropped the baby onto his right foot and booted it 10 meters. It's conditioning. That's what goalkeepers are meant to do. You didn't hear that from a Buddhist monk, did you? That's not a very Buddhist story. But the condition is like that, and very often we're creatures of conditioning, and sometimes it's hard to change our condition. But one of the worst conditionings we have is always like to be such complainers. And it's that negative response we have to much of life, when a lot of times we can't really do anything, the complaining is a waste of time. And we think, oh no, it just lets off steam. It doesn't let off steam, it just makes your mind more and more negative. And I notice as a Western community especially, and I think this is infecting Asian countries as well, we're just such great complainers, and we don't need to do that. One of the stories which shows why we shouldn't complain is that story of, they're not here this evening, the two Thai sisters who came to my monastery. And again, these little stories, they expand into some very profound understandings of the nature of our lives. Because these two Thai sisters, I tell this story often, I hope I haven't told it here recently, but I give so many talks, you know, I don't know actually what I taught last week, because in the meantime I've given about 3 or 4 talks elsewhere. So I don't know what I taught here, what I taught at the cancer group, what I taught somewhere else. So please excuse me. But anyway, it's a great story. These two sisters came to our monastery for counseling. And when I talked to the first, the elder sister, what's your problem? Her problem was her husband. Surprise, surprise. And she was having such a difficult time living with this man. And she was telling all the problems. And you know, as a Buddhist, we really try hard to keep the relationships together. You know, at all costs, you know, not at all costs, but, you know, we really put a lot of effort into trying to solve the problems in a marriage. So I tell you all the different ways of looking at the problem and trying to deal with it, a bit of like positive feedback to your husband and positive feedback towards yourself and all sorts of ways we can deal with the problem. But basically, her problem was, you know, she had a husband she didn't want, but she was stuck with. And then sort of, you know, I'd given as much as I could to her, so then I talked to her sister, what's your problem? And her problem that she was single. And no, she was quite attractive, but found it easier to find boyfriends. But she said every time, you know, maybe a month at most, we go out together and it all falls apart. I just can't keep a man. And he said, no, I'm getting a bit old now. I'm in my early 30s. I'm not quite sure whether I can actually find a partner in life. I don't want to grow old, you know, without anybody. I don't want to be lonely. But my problem is this, I can't find a husband. And of course, those of you who heard this story before know that I thought of a solution. A very obvious one. You know, your older sister had a husband she didn't want, and you want one. Your sisters, swap! And to this day, I'm so surprised they didn't agree on that wonderful, wise solution. But having said that and made them both laugh, then of course you get into the important part of that story. And the important part, and it's a very wonderful way of looking at life, is that when you're married, I told the woman with her husband, you have what we call in Buddhism husband dukkha. Dukkha means suffering. You have that particular type of suffering in life you call husband suffering. And for those of you who have had 2 or 3 in your life so far, you know, you've been remarried, you know it's pretty much the same. And there's a slight differentiation in the models, but they've all got the same engine underneath, you know, like these cars, you know. There might be sort of a different colour on the outside, but it's the same engine. And this is what we call husband suffering. And I told this lady, look, this is, you know, your symptom. You've got husband suffering. This is what it's like to have a husband. Now, I've never had a husband, but I've counseled so many people. It's quite clear as an objective bystander, which is what a monk is, that, you know, you've got that particular type of suffering. I've heard it many times before, called husband suffering. And I looked at her sister and said, you haven't got that suffering. You've got what we call single woman suffering. And that's what it's like when you're single. You have that other type of suffering. And I said, look, if you get rid of your husband, you won't have husband suffering anymore. You will have what your sister's got. Single woman suffering. And you, sister, if you find a guy and get married, yeah, you won't have that suffering you've got now. You would have married. You'd have the same suffering your sister's got. So just by getting a guy or getting rid of the guy doesn't mean you get rid of suffering. You just get a different flavour of ice cream. That's all. And that's actually a wonderful entry into some very profound teachings about life. Because very often this is what happens. We think, okay, you know, if I change my job, then I won't have suffering anymore. And it's true. If you change your job, you don't have that particular type of suffering. You have another type of suffering. Sometimes people are high flyers, and they've got the suffering of a high-pressure job. They decide to give that up and become a bus driver. They don't have CEO suffering anymore. They have bus driver suffering. Or teacher suffering. Sometimes we think we get some more money. I know Mr. Carpenter will love me for saying this. If we get some more money, then we won't have any suffering anymore. But a lot of times that when we try and change the externals, you know, we still have suffering. There are many, many people, have had it with having a husband, having a wife. They've had it sort of working in this world. They get so dispirited and so disillusioned, you know, with money and with getting houses and getting on in life, they decide to become a monk. And I have to tell them, look, you know, when you become a monk, you sure you don't have going to work on a Monday morning suffering. You have monk suffering. And I remember this very clearly as a young monk. I had what we call like young monk suffering when I was a junior monk. Because in Thailand, as a junior monk, we used to get the leftovers of the food. And, you know, sometimes I looked at those senior monks at the top of the line. And they had the best food because they had the first choice and I got what was left over. And I thought, this is really unfair. Because those monks have been monks 10, 20, 30 years. They probably were all enlightened by now and they didn't need nice, delicious food. I sort of had my defilements. So delicious food was wasting on those enlightened ones who come to me instead. And when I started thinking like this, they had all the biggest cushions to sit on. And you know, they never needed cushions. They were so fat, they had natural upholstery. They should have put the good cushions to me. And you know that we had to work hard, you know, labouring, as when I was a monk, you know, as a young monk. And those senior monks, they never had to labour. They were the ones who decided what all the projects would do. They organised us, but they never did any work at all. They just sat there talking with people all day. And it was really unfair. So I thought, wouldn't it be nice when I'm a senior monk? Now look at me. I've got my natural upholstery. I get first choice at the food. And I don't have to work in monastery anymore. Instead, I have to talk to all these sisters complaining about their husbands and their wives. And their... So I've got what's now called abbot suffering. Senior monk suffering. And that's true. And sometimes, even here this evening, sometimes you have to really work hard to try and get to that toilet. You know, before... Because when we started, there was a funeral this afternoon here. So we started the funeral about 5:15. I was out here talking to people. And, you know, if I didn't actually manage to get to the toilet, it would be 10 o'clock, almost 5 hours without having a toilet break. I think, oh, poor me, that's called abbot suffering. Or teacher suffering. But when you understand this is the part and the nature of the job, what do? Stop complaining. Because it's the complaining which is the worst part of the suffering. So instead of complaining, we understand it as well. This is what it's like to be a monk. This is what it's like to be a senior monk. This is what it's like to be a woman. This is what it's like to be gay. This is what it's like, you know, to be old and sick. So why do we complain about these things? Really, it's a bad attitude of life. That's the problem. When we understand, well, this is what it's like to be old. So I keep complaining about the aches and pains in the body. Complaining about the aches and the pains in the body is not going to make them go away. Actually, it makes them worse. So in Buddhism, we actually learn to change attitudes when we understand that first noble truth, that life, you know, is not sort of all a bowl of cherries. That life is not easy. Life is always happy. It always has some suffering into it, no matter what you are. Now, I thought that when I became a monk, I could actually get away from all this suffering business. You know, that I had girlfriends before, and I know there was just so much suffering. And I thought, wow, now I've become a monk. I'll be free of all of this. And I went off to Thailand, and I thought, wow, going to like Thailand, living in the jungles, living in the forests, finding nice caves. I would never have to bother with any. I had this fantasy of finding a nice cave and just sitting in there and becoming like not being bothered, leaving the whole world behind. Just maybe going out, eating your one meal a day, and then spending the rest of the time in solitude and peace. Blissing out on the peace of deep meditation, becoming enlightened. Oh, what a wonderful fantasy that was. I'll tell you one of the stories which broke my fantasy. I was in the north of Thailand. I was looking for these secluded monasteries. I found one with nice food. People didn't bother you over there. But it was a very big festival day. And when you had lots of people coming to the monastery, they were disturbing my meditation. But you know, you had to be there for the meal, and the monk was giving his chanting and his talk. But I had been in that monastery for quite a few days, so I tried to slip away. But as soon as I went away, the people come and ask me questions. And I was only a young monk. I didn't know much, you know, about meditation or much teaching, so I didn't really need to know very much, because all they weren't, even the lay people, they weren't interested in deep meditation or Buddhism. All they were interested in was me. They kept on asking the same question. They said, "No, what country do you come from? And you know, how many brothers and sisters have you got? And you know, what did you, you know, where did you go to school? And did you go to college? And what food did you eat?" You know, all those simple questions which people ask you when they haven't seen like a Westerner before. And when people after people ask you the same question, you get so bored. There's hundreds of people, 1,000 people came to the monastery for this big festival. They all asked the same question. Where are you from? How many brothers and sisters have you got? Where did you go to college? All those stupid questions. What food do you eat over there? I got so bored that I decided to sneak away. And I was successful. I managed to sneak into my hut, quickly grab a bottle of water and a cushion and a flashlight, and sneak into one of the caves. Because this was north of Thailand, some very, very deep caves. And I'd explored them before, and I'd meditated in them before. And I found the deepest of those caves. It was really remote, and I had to sort of crawl in up some passages and go left and right. It was maybe 100 meters deep till the end of the tunnel. And when I got there, I thought, great, I've escaped. And I sat down there with my bottle of water and my cushion and a flashlight. No one will bother me here. Ha ha ha. Only 5 minutes. 5 minutes was all I had when I heard a sound of something coming along the passages of the cave. I opened my eyes, and because it was like a bend in the end of the tunnel, I could see a light getting brighter and brighter as they came close, and I could hear their noises. And I thought, oh my goodness, they're coming in my direction. But I had a chance. Because one of them, one of these Thai people, when they came to the corner, and they poked their head around the corner, they saw me sitting there in meditation. And immediately he was afraid, and pulled his head back, and I heard a conversation. "There's a ghost at the end of the tunnel." That's what they thought, and I thought, I had a chance here. "There's a ghost at the end of the tunnel." And the other one said, "There can't be." "Yes, there is. Let's get out of here." "So let's have a look." And so two heads came around the corner. Very quickly, and they pull their heads back again. And that's when I heard the very, very sad conversation. "No, it's not a ghost, it's a Western monk." That was very dispiriting. And they looked around, "Yeah, it's a Western monk." So they all came, about 20 of them. They'd been so bored with the sermon of the senior monk, they too had decided to go and explore the caves. And they had to explore the cave which I was in. So they came right up to me, sat down, and said, "What country are you from? How many brothers and sisters have you got?" Oh, it was just so dispiriting. Even in the end of a 100-meter cave, you couldn't get away from these people. So I realized my mistake. But that's what it's like, being a monk. You can't escape from those things. Right? Even when I came to Australia, I had a fantasy, because I heard, you know, in the Nullarbor Plain, they've got these amazing caverns underneath the Nullarbor. And in the caverns, they've got, like, water underground. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great? I'd take some supplies, maybe 3 months of supplies, and go and live in the caves in the Nullarbor. No one lives there. Surely there they'd leave me alone. But then as I fantasized about being the hermit of the Nullarbor, I fantasized about what would happen next. Soon somebody would find me. Because people would always explore, and they'd find this old monk, the hermit of the Nullarbor. And they go back home and they tell new idea. I saw that in the newspapers. A new idea will be a feature on me, the hermit of the Nullarbor. And then after they did a feature of me, then the tour buses would start arriving. And when they had the tour buses, they'd have to have a cafe next to it, selling Devonshire teas and little certificates, I visited the hermit of the Nullarbor. And then Channel 9 would do a documentary. And that would be the end. That would be the end of the hermit of the Nullarbor. Now, that is actually feasible. The point is that even as a monk, you can't run away and hide. And if the more you complain about that, the more suffering you make for your life. So I understood very early in life that you're not in control of life. When you're not in control of life, you stop complaining. I'm not in control of what I have to do. Sometimes I work very hard and think, oh, why me? Why do I have to do this? But I learned a long time not to actually to complain, to look at another way. You can always have a positive attitude to whatever you have to do in life. Even I remember Ajahn Chah telling the story of the man who was walking along one day in the forest and he saw a big hole. And the bottom of the hole was a treasure worth millions. So he leaned over and tried to pick up the treasure. You know, the hole was just a bit too deep. He leant and stretched his arm, but he couldn't reach the treasure. And he was complaining, the hole's too deep, the hole's too deep. Another man came along and said, what's wrong? He said, look, there's a treasure down there, but I can't reach it, the hole's too deep. And the man said, you silly fellow, get out of the way, I'll show you what the problem is. And he got a stick. He said, it's not the fact the hole's too deep. The problem is your arm's too short. So he extended his arm with a stick and hooked the treasure out and went away. Now the moral of that story is, when we complain, the hole's too deep, the hole's too deep, the hole's too deep. A lot of time when we complain, we're not doing anything about it, we're just getting negative. It's never the fact that the hole's too deep. It's your arm is too short. And you can always extend your arm with a stick. I always remember that story. So instead of complaining, we always do something about it. Which is why one of those favourite sayings, which is in that book, Open the Door of Your Heart, always rather light a candle than complain about darkness. However, as human beings, we complain so much. We complain, complain, and complain. But hardly do we ever do anything. Now what complaining means is that we're rejecting so this present moment, which is produced by cause and effect, it's karma. That's why we have what we have now. Karma means that whatever you're experiencing right at this moment, you deserve. It's a hard one to take, isn't it? Sometimes you say, why me? It's unfair, it shouldn't have happened. But really, if you see the big picture, it's what you deserve. Now the most important thing is the second half of karma. Karma from the past gives you this moment now with all the problems and difficulties and all the happiness as well. The most important part of karma is what are you doing about this? What are you doing with what you have right now? And the most amazing thing about the law of karma is you can always make something out of whatever you have to deal with. You can always make, as I keep on saying, a beautiful juicy mango out of dog shit, if you know how to dig it in and wait for a while. You can always do something with what you have. And one of the most wonderful parts of life is hearing these stories of people who have gone through such terrible, terrible, terrible ingredients and made such a wonderful life for themselves. I remember the last time I told a story of when I went to Fremantle Jail some years ago, because I used to go teach prisoners in these different jails in Australia. When I went to Fremantle Jail, you know, one of the things you notice in the old Fremantle Jail, as soon as you went in there, there was nothing green. It was all this, the Fremantle limestone. And some of the prisoners said, who'd been in there many, many years, that they'd forgotten what the colour green looked like. And also that there's so many buildings and there's such small courtyards, they'd had to look up to see far distances, and they would very rarely do that. They said one of the first things which they noticed when they were released after 10, 15 years was to see like green trees, flowers, and to see far distances. And I could understand that, visiting into that jail. It was a very, very nasty place to live. But the social worker who greeted me when I first went into that jail was a Czechoslovakian girl. And I remember her story and just what a wonderful woman she was, so much so that 10, 15 years ago now, her name was Dasha Simkova. She was one of my heroes, because she told me what happened to her. She was about 16 or 17 in 1966 when the Soviet tanks came into Prague. They were behind the Iron Curtain, there was a communist regime, but they had a leader, Alexander Dubček, who was reforming the state and giving more freedoms and liberalizing the oppressive regime, with the huge support of his people. But that upset the Soviet Union so much that they sent their tanks in to reclaim the country. She was one of the people who stood on the streets protesting. That's all she was doing, just protesting for the freedom of her country. No crime, no violence, just standing up silently protesting. She was arrested and put in jail for, I think, 25 years. 25 years of your young life, 16 or 17 year old, and this was in an East European jail. She told me that how she was beaten regularly. That was par for the course. There was no Amnesty International in those jails. It was behind the Iron Curtain. Could have been less than 20, I think 20 years, not 25 or whatever. But she was regularly beaten. But she said, even though she'd done nothing more than protest for the freedom of her country, and she was so young, and that sentence was taken the best years of her life, of her young life, she said that she would never allow herself to get angry. Even during the beatings, she would never allow herself to feel ill will towards those people who were perpetrating that violence against her. She said that was the only thing which she could protect, her freedom not to react. Now you can imagine what a strong-willed and wise person she was, which was why when I met her many years later, she'd eventually been released and resettled in Australia. And she told me, she, being the social worker in Fremantle Jail, no matter how hard it was there, whenever any prisoner complained, she'd take them into her office and tell them what a real prisoner is like. And they went back outside saying, oh, Fremantle Jail is a wonderful place, it's a wonderful place. But it was her attitude which really impressed me. Just how, instead of complaining about the terrible situation she'd been placed in, how instead of complaining, she'd made something very wonderful out of this. Training her mind to not give in to anger with such a long time of persecution. Now you may know people like that. What they do is show you inspiration that something else is possible in life. Instead of actually complaining and having ill will, sometimes we can actually make something out of things we can't change. Because that complaining attitude which we have means we don't see other opportunities. We think, why does this happen to me? This is not right. We're complaining about the ingredients of our present moment instead of realizing that That's karma from the past. Now what are you doing about it now? There is something you can do. I mentioned that story last Saturday. No, sorry, not last Saturday, last Tuesday, because I was in Sydney. I was meeting a man there who had been falsely accused of a terrible crime, but his trial went badly. He faces 25 years in jail. Talking with some of the other monks there, they were convinced he was completely innocent, but sometimes this happens. But I was taught how to understand this by one of the other prisoners who I got to know. This was Incarnate Prison Farm. He was one of these old prisoners who had been in and out of jail most of his life. And he was a very funny man. And he joined my meditation class, and after a few sessions, he asked if he could have a private chat with me after the class, which I readily agreed to. And he told me that the reason he wanted to talk to me was because he was innocent. He said the crime for which he'd been put in jail for was a robbery he never committed. One of his friends did that job, not him. And he'd been put in jail for a crime which he didn't do. Now I know from my experience in teaching in jails that when you're inside, you only have very limited access, especially to a telephone, very little money. So there's very little you can do to redress injustices. But I was always an idealist, and I thought, he can't do anything, but I can. I know some Buddhist lawyers. I know some people in government. Maybe I should fight his case for him. And I started thinking of all the people I would ring up as soon as I got back to my monastery down at Serpentine. And as I was thinking about this, he interrupted my thoughts with a very cheeky smile. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, I'm innocent of this crime. I didn't do that robbery. But there are so many other burglaries where I wasn't caught. I guess this is fair." And I laughed, and that fellow taught me the law of karma. Because I realized that, yeah, he hadn't done that crime for which he was put in jail for, but how many other crimes had he done where he got away with it? And sometimes I thought, how many times do you complain when you're caught speeding by the speed cameras? And it's really unfair. But how many times have you been speeding and you weren't caught by the speed cameras? Do you ever say, that's unfair? I was doing 10Ks over the limit, and there wasn't a speed camera there. That's unfair. Or you do any other naughty thing and you're not caught. Do you ever say, that's not fair? Sometimes the way we complain is we don't see the big picture. Sometimes life is fair. That's what that law of karma says. We get everything we deserve. So if something has gone wrong, what do? You stop complaining about it, and instead you think, what can I do about this? So we don't go blaming the past, which is unchangeable, nor do we blame the present, which is right here. We become proactive, we think, okay, we're in this situation, I'm going to go to jail, I've lost my wife, I've lost my kids, I've lost my money, what are you going to do about this? So instead of complaining, we learn how to do something with whatever we have. And the wonderful thing when you have that type of attitude is nothing which you can't make use of to learn and grow and become a better person from. Nelson Mandela was in jail for 26, 27 years. Look what he did when he was in jail. Now other people have had gross injuries, either in car accidents or other tragedies. It's amazing just how that has sometimes changed their lives. Some people have experienced other tragedies, people dying or children committing suicide. Instead of complaining, they've learned a lot about what life truly is. Which is why, you know, that we had this funeral this afternoon, and many of you who are here a little bit early, you know, saw the coffin going past, saw me following it. Traditional Buddhists would understand that was 2 out of the 4 messengers of truth. In the story of the Buddha, a nice young man, wealthy family, healthy body, the reason why he left home to become a monk was he saw 4 sights. the old man, the sick man, the dead man, and then the holy man. What that really meant to him was that he saw something about the nature of life. That this is what our life is. We have got old age, we have got sickness, we have got death. We have got disappointments. Things don't always go the way we want them to. Husbands are husbands, wives are wives, kids are kids. And what do you expect of a 13, 14, 15-year-old child? And I know so many parents come up and say, oh, my girl, my boy is not sort of talking properly to me, they're not respecting me. And the standard answer is, well, how did you treat your parents when you were that age? It's karma. For many of you, it is. But whatever it is, that sometimes this is the nature of kids at that age. They're just going through their thing. When you understand sort of what you can expect of life, and you don't ask for more than you can expect, you don't ask for more than life can give you, but you live within life's boundaries, and don't try and make more out of life than it can give you, then we can actually understand where we don't need to complain anymore. I mean, we make use of whatever we have. And when we make use of whatever we have, that's what we call making good karma in the present moment. So whatever we have, we don't get angry at it, we don't get upset at it. We learn how to employ it to make a better, happier, beautiful life. So stop complaining. Do something. If there's something to do. And that becomes this positive attitude towards the difficulties of life. Complaining is wasting time. Not being active or proactive. It's amazing just what you can do with that type of attitude. Even, I remember during the tsunami crisis, I mentioned that already. Oh, no, sorry, I was mentioning that during the funeral service. During the tsunami crisis, somebody called me up from the local media to ask what was a Buddhist idea of what caused a tsunami. Because many sort of people who believed in God said it was God's punishment for something or other, I don't know what. Or it was, you know, the price of sin or whatever. And they asked me, what's the Buddhist idea? Why did the tsunami happen? Is it because people's bad karma? Or why did it happen? And my response was straight away, look, what does it matter why it happened? What's most important, it has happened, what are we doing about it? Instead of wasting time trying to figure out why it happened, trying to find someone to blame, there are people there who have got no homes, who are hungry, who are injured, who are in pain. What we're supposed to do is actually to try and help those people. Instead of complaining about the darkness, let's light some more candles. I always remember the media person said, wow, I've rang so many people today, that's the first piece of sensible advice I've got. And he praised me for that. He rather praised Buddhist attitude towards the problems of life. We'd stop complaining, but we'd do something about it. And you know that we can do a huge amount to solve these problems. But the way we solve those problems is not blaming anybody. I still remember one of the former prime ministers of Thailand who came to see Ajahn Chah, and he was talking to me afterwards. And he told me, he said, there's never any problem when I was in prime minister, it's only for 1 year. When I was a prime minister, there was never any problem I could not solve by going to see my adversary, just the two of us, putting my hand on his knee, which was not an expression of being gay, it was an expression of like friendship in Thailand. With that expression of friendship to my adversary and just talking it over, there's no problem, he said, we could never solve together. I was very impressed with that because he was a sincere man and a prime minister of a big country. I thought that was impossible. But it's amazing with that goodwill and friendship just how we can solve problems. But when we complain, like in a marriage, we do complain. It's your fault, husband, or it's your fault, wife. When we start complaining like that, without friendship, of course, there never can be solutions. And that's what complaining starts. When you complain, it's like blaming somebody, or blaming yourself, or blaming the government. And with that type of mind of complaining and finding fault, what we're doing, we're not finding solutions, we're finding faults. That's what complaining is. No wonder it doesn't work. Instead of finding faults, we should be finding solutions. And sometimes solutions are so hard to find, we need everybody included. Different perspectives, different ideas, because solutions are that difficult. But of course, you can't find a solution when you're looking for the faults. So instead of complaining, we do something about it. We try and find solutions. And then sometimes there isn't solutions. When it's not a solution, again, it's not a problem, is it? I told us, I think, was it last week, with that story from Harold Macmillan, the former British Prime Minister? I could have told us in Sydney, I'm not sure, but that particular story, again, is one of these little anecdotes which changed much of the way I looked at my life. Because I'm a spiritual director of Buddhist Society of WA, sometimes we call it spiritual dictator of Buddhist Society of WA, the head of the monastery down at Boss Monk of Serpentine Monastery. I've got so many responsibilities. I have to be very efficient with the way I use my mind. And this is actually one of the reasons how I can hold so much responsibility without getting too stressed out. Because this Prime Minister was once asked, during the time of the Six-Day War between Israel, Palestine, Jordan, and Egypt and Syria and Lebanon, fighting a war against these surrounding countries. It was called the Six-Day War. During the middle of that crisis, the newspapers interviewed the former British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, and they said straight away, "Sir, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East?" And this elder statesman, he'd retired at the time, said, "Sir, there is no problem in the Middle East." "There is no problem in the Middle East," he replied. And the reporter said, "How can you say that? As we speak, there's a war going on. People are dying. Tanks are shelling buildings. People are being wounded. What do you mean there's no problem?" And his response was brilliant. He said, "Sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it can't be a problem." Now, that's one of those unexpected sayings which, when you contemplate it, has a huge amount of wisdom which saves so much suffering. A problem is something with a solution. There's no solution. It's not a problem. In other words, it's a waste of time even thinking about it, because you can't be effective. Now, how many times do we complain about things which aren't problems? In other words, things which don't have a solution. You complain about someone who's died. That particular type of complaining is called grief. Sometimes you complain about something you did in the past which you shouldn't have done. That type of complaining is called guilt. Or you complain about what someone else did. It's called anger. How many types of complaining are there? Most of them aren't problems. You can't do anything about it. It's done. But there are other times when you can do something about it. And it's not just trying to change the past. It's always the AFL code: acknowledge, forgive, no blame, and learn from whatever happened. It's amazing just how much we can grow with that AFL code: acknowledge, forgive, and learn. But no complaining. And some of the things which we learn is actually to expect less out of life, to expect less from our partner. When you expect less, you can appreciate more. It's an amazing thing that where we see the faults in another person, we can't see their good qualities. That's why complaining just looks at the negative side of a person, about life or about yourself. Have you ever noticed that? It's just like those psychology puzzles where you can look at a glass and it's either two people looking at each other or it's a vase. You can't see both at the same time. Perception doesn't allow you to have both perceptions in your mind simultaneously. It's the same time thing. You can't have fault finding and love at the same time. You either complain or you've got compassion. You don't have both. When you understand that, you understand how every time we have a complaining mind, we miss the opportunity to have a compassionate, embracing mind. Of those two, which one would you rather develop? The compassionate mind sees the other person with all their faults and embraces their faults with their good qualities, and seeing they're a human being. They're not perfect, they do make mistakes. You love them for who they are. The compassionate mind just loves life for what it is. Sure, it has its God, its disappointments, its pain, its sicknesses, and its death. We love life for what it is. Complaining about life and thinking, oh, may there never be any sickness. May there never be any death. May my marriage never have any arguments. May I always get promotions at work. May the government always do the right thing. Come and get real. Sometimes our compassion stops seeing the faults in things and sees the big picture, the beauty, as well as the mistakes. Now that's a powerful thing in life, because when we start to develop that positive mind, the mind of compassion rather than complaining, it changes the whole picture. What we actually find, it was actually the complaining, the negativity, was perpetuating the faults. Where do those mistakes and faults come from? Why do people argue with each other? Why do husbands and wives find difficulty living with each other? Why do governments, you know, always make these stupid decisions? Why is life like this? A lot of times it's because we put far too much complaining and fault-finding and too little understanding and compassion. What was it like with you growing up? You may have been fortunate to have a parent who was kind to you, could forgive your faults, and was compassionate. I was fortunate to have a father like that. I was amazed that somehow, sometimes I thought I'd get punished for it, but he would say, never mind. That taught me a huge amount by having a parent who had more compassion than fault-finding. And I grew strongly to deserve that compassion. And that's what I found in life. When you're compassionate to the other people you live with, I'm kind to my monks rather than fault-finding, they become far better monks. You try and fault-find, beat them down, tell them all the mistakes they've made. What does that do? Have you had that experience when you were young? Always having your faults and mistakes pointed out? You just get dispirited, you give up. What's the point of trying? That's what happens with complaining. You don't have any positive input. You get negative yourself. You just get depressed and give up. Or you just fight back with complaints of your own. Is that any way to live? Is that any way to have a relationship? When you're brought up like that, you also start complaining about yourself. You're not good enough. I'm not wise enough. I'm not clever enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not strong enough. I still remember the first year I came to Australia. I was number 2 monk, but I had to do a lot of work as well. And I remember one weekend, this man called up. He made an interview for counselling for his 15-year-old daughter. I'd never done much counselling before, but I was willing to give it a try. But he never told me what the problem was. So this young girl came in, a pretty young girl. What's your problem? And she was looking down at the floor. It took me about 10 or 15 minutes to get out what was causing her such anxiety and depression. You know what her problem was? She told me her nose was too big. It's so sweet now. What do you mean your nose is too big? Now put your head up so I can have a look at it. And I was a bit stupid at the time. You know, I decided to be the scientist. So I looked at her nose and I gave a quick measure. I never got the ruler out. But, you know, I can understand what a couple of centimetres was. And I looked at her and said, you know, well, I've had many girlfriends. You know, your nose is actually quite average. It's not big. It's not small. It's not what we'd call like an exceptional nose. Or not even an ugly nose. It's, you know, it's right in the middle, like a good Buddhist way, middle way nose. And that was my objective opinion, but that obviously never had any effect on her whatsoever. Because she was so depressed because she thought she had a big nose. Now see, that's what complaining does. You find something wrong with you. If you haven't got a big nose, you've got crooked teeth. Or if you haven't got crooked teeth, you've got bad hair. You've always got something wrong with you. If you've got a fault-finding mind, you're going to really suffer. If you've got a fault-finding mind, you can never find anyone to live with, not even yourself. And that's the cause of so much problems in our world. People can't even, they can't find a partner, they can't even have a good time with themselves. They're always seeing their faults. So that's why it's wonderful to see, stop all this complaining, have more compassion. More compassion to the person you live with. They're trying their best, believe it or not. People actually do try their best to get on. They do try their best at work, even though sometimes you don't believe that, but that's the case. In a relationship, people are really trying. And you try your best too. Everyone who's here today, you've really worked so hard to be who you are. You've tried. And what happens? You just get complaints. You're not good enough. What happens then? You just give up. You get worse. A bit of encouragement, a bit of praise, instead of complaining, works wonders. When I started seeing that in the Buddha's teachings, he called it, stop the fault-finding mind. And instead develop a mind which doesn't see faults, but which sees the positive side, which praises, which is grateful, which finds contentment. If that lady came to me now, she's probably, it must have been 20 years ago now, 25 years ago now. If a lady like that came and said, be content with your nose. Have a contentment, don't be so fault-finding. Because if one can do that in life, one will find it very easy to actually not find fault with a partner, not find fault with your children, not find fault with your body when it gets old, not find fault with death, not find fault with the dogs next door. When you don't have that fault-finding mind, how much peace, contentment and happiness can you build? A huge amount. And that's exactly what I teach when people learn how to meditate. I don't know how many people, when they first start meditating, sometimes they live their life one way and they meditate another way. And the same as when you sit quietly down, stop finding faults with your own mind because it's tired or it's sleepy. If you fall asleep, fine. Well done. At least you're peaceful. So you don't find fault with yourself or with your meditation. Instead of having a complaining mind, oh, my meditation wasn't good this day. Oh, I was my thinking too much. I was doing this, I was doing that. That complaining, you know, that's actually what stops you being peaceful when you meditate. It's great when we stop complaining. In meditation we call using the mantra, this is good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough. No matter what it is, this is good enough. Had great success by using that mantra in meditation retreats. People that are meditating along and are having a difficult time say, look, stop whatever you're doing. Just remind yourself like a mantra, words you repeat to yourself again and again, this is good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough. That means they start complaining. You know what happens next? When they stop complaining, they have this idea, this is good enough. They go through the next stage. They realize, actually, this is good enough. And from that, they get to the next stage. Actually, this is quite nice. And then they get to the next stage. This is bloody nice. Next stage, this is wonderful. And then they start pissing out. This is a standard process as a meditation teacher I see with people. Because when they stop complaining, then they can start to see the beauty in this moment. It was there all along. But sometimes all we can see is the big nose. We can't see the rest of the beautiful face. When you stop complaining, this is good enough. The world starts to look more beautiful. And it looks even more beautiful. And the happiness, which you cannot describe, starts to arise. Not just in your meditation, but in your whole life. It's amazing when people learn how to stop complaining so much that they don't have so much to complain about. The more you complain, the more you make the world miserable. Which is what the law of karma is all about. You create your world. If you're a complainer, you create this very negative, dark, miserable world for yourself and the people who know you. The law of karma means that you are the creator, not a god, not the government. You create your world. When you realize how important, how true that is. Every time you complain, you're just making more black clouds over the sky. So this is good enough. We start. And then we realize it's actually quite wonderful and quite nice. That's why I've been a monk for 34 years now. I'm having a wonderful time as a monk. Sometimes people say, how can you do that? Such a tough life as a monk. You can't do this and you can't do that. There's so many rules we can't, so many things we can't do. But one thing I can always do is to be happy. And not complain. Even the food I get, got no choice. It's just put in my bowl. So I stop complaining. And just enjoy it. Wonderful food. The more you stop complaining, the more peace and happiness you have. So instead of finding faults, we find solutions. Instead of seeing what's wrong, we see what's right. We create a right world, a beautiful world, a good world. You can try that in life. Try that in your meditation. Next time you sit quietly, just stop complaining. You'll find when you stop complaining, there's hardly anything to think about. You ever notice that most of the thoughts you have are all complaints? If you stop complaining, the mind is quiet. If you stop complaining at home, there'll be much more silence in your house, much more peace, and much more happiness. So, if one learns how to stop complaining, it becomes the path to peace, to happiness, to liberation, and even to freedom. You create your world. That means the law of karma. So what type of world do you want to create? Your life is in your hands. Da da da. So that's the talk this evening on no complaints. Nah, not long enough. I'm not going to buy that one. I know you're trying to make me complain about you saying that. It's a wonderful thing you said. Thank you so much for saying that. It's just good enough. So has anyone got any questions, comments, or complaints? Yes. Is there a yes question? Yes?
I'm trying to distinguish the difference between complaints and talking to a thing. You know what I mean? Because
okay.
Internalize it and get even
worse. Okay, yeah. How do you distinguish between complaining and talking through things? I think the key parts of this talk, which many of you may have noticed, because when I said this, I noticed that many of you paid attention, is complaining is finding faults. Wisdom is finding solutions. And there's a huge difference between those two. So we're not finding faults, we're finding solutions. It's not why did this happen or who did it and trying to punish them. It's finding solutions for this. Moving forward rather than lingering in the past. Complaining is all about the past. Who did what to whom? Why did it happen? Find a solution. Don't find fault. Does that understand that? Okay. Next question. Yes. Okay. Should you have personal boundaries and try to be mindful, but sometimes it's difficult putting these teachings into practice in life. Yeah, it's difficult putting these teachings into practice, but you know, we learn basically that the more you try, the harder it gets. So after a while, you know, you just give up and you just allow it to grow naturally. So, you know, with all these teachings you have here, basically it is brainwashing. I admit to that. this spray washing in a good way. And if it doesn't work, you won't come back again. So there is like a safeguard there. And little by little, you come back and you do find you change. But the more you try to change, so the slower it will be. And that's why the change in your character, the change in the way you look at life, sometimes you don't notice it, but your partner does. And your kids do, your parents notice it. But you don't notice it at all because, you grow so slowly, so incrementally. And this is what happens. It's wonderful to see this. I said, during meditation, that sometimes people, they don't want to come to meditation because they've had a hard week at work. And you've got to come all the way over here and spend your evening over here, meditate, listen to talks. And I remember many years ago, I was teaching in the Armidale meditation group, and this lady told me afterwards, I never wanted to come tonight. I was tired, had a busy day, had to cook dinner for my family, and I just wanted to put my feet up and watch anything on the TV, didn't matter what, I was tired. But my children said, Mummy, you must go to meditation. I said, no, I'm tired. Mummy, go to meditation. Why? Because Mummy, you're a much nicer mummy when you come back from meditation. And I told that story a couple of weeks ago, and afterwards, a lady came up, and she said, that happened to me tonight. Exactly the same. She never wanted to come, but her children said, Mummy, you're much nicer when you go to meditation. She never noticed it, but her kids did. So a lot of times, the growth in these teachings, they just happen naturally. And as far as your personal boundaries are concerned, that sometimes our personal boundaries expand and expand and expand and expand to include more things as we become more peaceful and more compassionate in life. Which means we need to protect ourselves less and less and less. We have nothing much to protect anymore. You can be more open to everybody. It's a wonderful thing to have that when your boundaries, because the boundaries are sometimes what's between you and another person. And sometimes those boundaries expand and expand until they include everybody. I remember doing this as a meditation many years ago. I haven't taught this for such a long time now. I imagined in my meditation, when I got peaceful, I imagined a circle. Inside that circle was all the people I liked and all the things in life I approved of and liked. And just outside the circle were the people and the things, the experiences and situations. I didn't really detest them, but they're not so nice. And the further they were out from the center of my circle, the more I hated them. And a long way out were my enemies, the situations, the things I really did not like. And I imagined in this meditation just expanding my circle. Now, first of all, to include the people and the experiences, which I never detested, but, was pretty ambivalent towards, including them in my circle of things I liked. Expanding that circle more and more and more until the boundaries got so big. They just expanded into infinity. And I'd embrace even the people I hated. I'd embrace the situations I disliked. I embraced the hurt of the past. Everything became included within my circle. It was actually another way of looking at personal boundaries and expanding them so much. They included everybody. Everyone was inside and nothing was left outside. That's why sometimes boundaries are sometimes a bit of a problem. Yeah? Okay, yeah. It's true, because they take a lot from me too. But yeah, there's a time when you say, okay, that I'm also inside my circle. So if you do open yourself up very, very much, that sometimes some people, because they need so much, sometimes they do take and take, 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 take. They squeeze as much out of you as they possibly can. I remember going to a talk over in one centre some years ago, and I actually caught them. I overheard them say, oh, look, we better sort of ask some more questions to squeeze as much out of him as we possibly can before he goes back to monastery. And I got a bit upset at the time, but I thought, no, you can squeeze as much out of me as you possibly can. Because usually that I know now the more I give, the more I have to give, the more there's there to be given. It's a wonderful thing, just when you really let go of your boundaries completely, if you can have the courage to do that. Yeah, sure, you feel tired physically, but emotionally you feel just so wonderful. That's what happens to me so often. I'd sometimes teach all day and get physically very exhausted, but emotionally just so charged. And of the two, I'd rather have the emotional happiness and the physical tiredness. So, but, you know, sometimes you say, well, that's enough for now, because you count as well. So sometimes you've got to look after yourself and be kind and compassionate towards yourself. But don't complain about life, about people sort of squeezing as much out of you as they possibly can. That's just life. So I'm very happy that happens. And just, but then again, every time I say, okay, it's time to go to bed now. So I go back to my room and have a good rest. So you do the same. Give yourself space as well. Don't know if that answered your question, but... And you're not complaining, so you've listened to the talk. Okay, so that's another talk off the cuff. Never knew I was going to talk about that tonight until the dog started complaining. So this talk is dedicated to those wonderful dogs outside who taught me how not to complain. So thank you for listening. Now we have a couple of announcements before we go.
With the new committee being elected tomorrow, there will be a new president from here or here next Friday, and so I won't be here, and I'll be retiring from the activities. So I hope we'll all be able to make good use of the facilities that are and services that are offered by the Buddhist Society, and reach whatever goals we aspire to. Thank you. And we can pay our respects to the Buddha.
Buddha Dhamma, yes. Very good.
Sankhan namami.